On this episode of Skeptico, near-death experience skeptic, Dr. Susan Blackmore.
It's absolutely true. I haven't written about this subject for a long time, and I haven't kept up with all the literature either.
Well, it sounds very unscientific for anyone who claims to be a researcher in the field.
But I don't. I mean, that you're absolutely right. I wouldn't have said that before I gave up all this stuff 15 years ago. Of course I wouldn't have said that, because if you are a researcher in the field, it behoves you to read, you know, really as much as you can of the best work, because otherwise you can't be a researcher in the field. But I am not a researcher in the field. I have not been for a long time.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, we're diving right back into near-death experience. Now, if you've been with this show for a while, you know I've been hitting this topic quite a bit, pretty hard, the last few months. And again, it's not because I have any personal experience with it. It's just that, well, the near-death experience phenomena seems to get right to the core of what this show is all about, which is a scientific understanding of the biggest, deepest questions we could possibly ask. Who are we? Where did we come from? And where do we go? And nothing really gets to those questions more clearly, more directly, than near-death experience. Now, I've been saying for quite some time on this show that the evidence we get from the near-death experience research, that being that somehow, in some way, consciousness survives our bodily death. I mean, that's the conclusion from this body of research. I've been saying that's, well, uncontested. But there is one name that seems to keep cropping up in terms of an alternative view on the near-death experience, and that's Dr. Susan Blackmore. And I'll give you some examples of how it comes up. If you remember, a few months ago, I had an interview with Yale neurologist Dr. Stephen Novella, popular guy on the skeptical circuit, intelligent guy, kind of a go-to guy within the skeptical community because he has all the right credentials and he should know about all this stuff. And let me play for you as a little reminder a little bit of the exchange I had with Steve and how this research from Dr. Blackmore is in his thought process.
Different people interpret that data differently, different researchers looking at NDEs and different scientists. I know, have you interviewed Susan Blackmore, by the way?
I've read Susan Blackmore, 20 years ago, and I don't think she stands up very well. And so once you have a guy like Dr. Steve Novella make reference to Susan Blackmore, you know that that's going to be picked up by the other skeptical folks out there. And it is, for example, if you recall my interview with DJ Grothy, the president of the James Randi Educational Foundation, he said this.
Person I like a lot, and her explanations in this regard are Susan Blackmore.
And even folks within the skeptical community who admit not being well-informed on near-death experience, like New Testament scholar Bob Price, who we interviewed a few episodes back, they seem to have in the back of their mind some idea that Susan Blackmore has put forth some really solid research on NDEs. Here's what Bob said.
I've not read her, but what do you think of Susan Blackmore? I believe she got into the study of this believing in it and came out saying, nah, there's really another explanation, though I've not read her.
So with so many people within the skeptical / atheist camp pointing to Dr. Susan Blackmore as a possible way out of the near-death experience phenomena and its implications, I really wanted to talk to her again. I talked to her a couple years ago, and she is a very gracious person, but I was very happy when she accepted my invitation for a second interview on Skeptico. I think you'll find it fascinating. It's very provocative. It's challenging at times, but it's really everything that Skeptico is all about, asking tough questions in an effort to nudge a little bit closer to the scientific truth about things as best we can get there. So stay with me for Dr. Susan Blackmore. Today we welcome back Dr. Susan Blackmore. She's a writer, lecturer. In fact, you may have seen her excellent presentation at the TED conference a couple years ago, which is quite an honor in itself. She's also a visiting professor in psychology at the University of Plymouth. Dr. Blackmore, welcome back to Skeptico.
Thank you very much.
Well, as I explained in my email, you know, the main reason I wanted to have you back on is because as we've dug in this show into near-death experience science, and we tried to explore what skeptics have to say about this and whether this is really evidence for consciousness existing outside of the brain, well, the more we dig into that, your name seems to keep popping up. I have always said, hey, you know, Susan Blackmore hasn't published on this in 15 years. I don't know where you're going, but nonetheless, I keep getting a lot of, you need to read Susan Blackmore's book. So I thought it'd be nice to have you back on and clear up some of these questions.
Well, thank you very much. It's absolutely true. I haven't written about this subject for a long time, and I haven't kept up with all the literature either. I do, you know, I hear about some of the things that are happening. I talk to people involved. I know Peter Fenwick, for example, very well. So I kind of know what's going on to some extent. But I got to the point many, many years ago when I just thought, I have done all I feel I can do for the moment, and I just need to get out of these endless round and round arguments and do something else that I have. I mean, I've spent my time investigating other aspects of consciousness and mystical experiences and meditation and memes and evolution and all sorts of other things. And, you know, I'm glad to have got out of that. Why people go on referring to, I suppose I provided some sort of position for people to argue against. I mean, people who persist in thinking that near-death experiences are evidence for life after death or evidence of a soul or a spirit or something really hate any proposals that come from basic physiology or understanding what the brain's up to and so on. And, you know, I did lay out that I hope fairly clearly in my book. So I guess they'll go on referring to it until or unless the whole argument dissolves one way or the other. Either we have truly fantastic physiological explanations which really do the whole job and there's nothing left to argue with, or we get some stunning evidence that, you know, I was completely wrong and there really is life after death or a spirit or soul or something like that. So I think people will go on mentioning that work I did a long time ago, even if it's only as what they want to prove wrong.
Yeah, I don't quite see it that way, and I hope we can tease that out, because like the article that I sent you from Dr. Bruce Grayson at the University of Virginia, where he does a lit review of the research, particularly the research in the last 15 years, I can't really say that it... That everyone's so stuck on some of the ideas that you're saying, but maybe we can really get into that. You know, where I thought would be a starting point is really the email that you sent me, and you just reiterated here, because when I invited you on the show and I said, hey, why does your name keep popping up? You said, here's your email. It says, I know about AWARE, that is Dr. Peter Fenwick and Sam Parnia, their project, but not Jeff Long's work, because I told you that Jeff Long had, you know, just published a book, and he had been on the show, and I wanted you to comment on that. And then you said, I'm not sure I could face reading his book, though, so I probably wouldn't be much use to you. So what immediately pops to my mind is, one, I appreciate the honesty that you probably couldn't face reading the book, but I just, on the face of it, that just seems like a stunning statement. I mean, here's a guy, he's obviously well-qualified, he's a medical doctor, he's done more research than, you know, just about anybody. He appears at all the right conferences, publishes all the right papers, and you say you couldn't face reading his book.
It does sound absolutely dreadful, doesn't it? Oh, dear, please forgive me.
It's dreadful. It sounds very unscientific for anyone who claims to be a researcher in the field.
But I don't. I mean, that you're absolutely right. I wouldn't have said that before I gave up all this stuff 15 years ago. Of course I wouldn't have said that, because if you are a researcher in the field, it behoves you to read, you know, really as much as you can of the best work, because otherwise you can't be a researcher in the field. But I am not a researcher in the field. I have not been for a long time, you know, because I felt I had to get out. It was the same with all of the parapsychological things, which I really stopped doing about 10 years ago, because it was a similar reason, really. Was sent a massive material on Stargate affair, which was a very big argument about US government funded research on remote viewing and so on. And I thought, if I'm going to make any comments on this, I have got to read all this stuff. And I had come to the point when I had had enough and I didn't want to do it anymore. And I had to reorganize my life and say, I'm not going to do that anymore. Because what I was never prepared to do, and still I'm not prepared to do, is to say, you know, yeah, I'm an expert on this, I know about this, and then not go and read the stuff. So my honesty, I'm glad I was honest, I am honest. You know, I haven't done that for a very long time, and that's why I said I don't think I'd be much use to you. And initially I didn't want to do this interview because I felt I'm not a researcher in the field, I'm not up to date with the work, you know, I'm not the right person for you to talk to. And then you said, well, you know, people still refer to your work, so if you want to talk to me, then please let me talk as honestly as I am. I am ignorant about quite a lot of what has gone on in the last 15 years. Let me say one more thing. Why I couldn't face reading it is nothing to do with something to do with the content, but I don't know what the content is. Look, I'm sitting near my desk now. The piles of books in the urgent must read because I've got to review by next week pile. Then the, oh, I'd love to read, but, you know, there'll be next pile. And then the really hopeless, huge pile as tall as my desk of books people have sent me and they want me to read. And God knows when I'm going to read them. You know, that's the setting for that comment.
We can all relate.
Of course you can. Of course you can. So I wouldn't read this book because that's not something that is not the field I'm working in anymore. And I've got other things to do.
I appreciate that. But Sue, that's not exactly what you said. And even in the email to me, and you kind of reiterated it in the early part of this broadcast, you said that, you know, you don't want to get back to it unless there's some really fantastic evidence. And you say, this is in your email. Of course, there may be some really fantastic evidence in Long's book, but I doubt it. And,
Indeed, no one has told me. Come on, prove me wrong, then. Well, prove me wrong. Tell me what there is.
Well, but hold on.
Maybe there is. You know.
Hold on. I mean, you're still a public figure, public intellectual, public scientist, and you know, to remove yourself, I think is fine. But you still express a very strong opinion about this, and when we juxtapose that with what you just said, which I'm completely uninformed, I really have no opinion because I haven't studied the literature in 15 years, and a lot has happened in 15 years. I mean, don't we need to kind of resolve those to a certain extent?
Well, that's a good question. I think because of the way it went, that research, and in particular, all of my research in parapsychology. It's always very, very frustrating. What happens is you have any number of claims of things which, if they were true, would fundamentally overthrow, you know, everything we understand really about the nature of mind. And if it were true, you know, it'd be amazing and would change everything. You go and investigate these things, and over the nearly 30 years I was involved in parapsychology, I investigated lots and lots and lots of things. Some of them turn out to be very easy to solve the mystery, and you find very quickly there's some normal explanation. Others, you can spend years getting to the bottom of them, and you ultimately get there, and you say, oh, that, you know, that's somebody cheated, or somebody made a mistake, or whatever it might be. And then some others you never do resolve. But they, in my experience of all those years, those ones were never convincing enough. There were never any witnesses or any written records independently of the main claim or whatever it was to force me to say, yeah, I must overthrow everything you know. That is where my remark, I doubt it, is coming from. It also comes from another source, which is that I still know enough people, although I don't see them much or communicating with them that much, but I still know people in the field. And I suspect if there were the kind of, if something happened that was really compelling, for example, the success of some project like AWARE, somebody tell me, you know, then I would go back and have a look. It would throw me. It would be kind of challenging and difficult, but also very exciting. But you know, something like that. So that's really where my I doubt it is coming from.
Okay, so then the people you know, I mean, I assume you're talking about like Dr. Peter Fenwick. Who else are you talking about? And what are they? What are they telling you in terms of there not being any fantastic research?
Well, to give an example, a few months ago, Peter came down to Plymouth, where both of us had been invited to take part in a day organized by some schools in Plymouth. It was a very nice day with discussions about near-death experiences. And he told me about the AWARE project and various other things that were going on. And I gave a lecture. This was with school kids, so you know, this was not a scientific conference. This was. I feel perfectly able to do that when invited, although I don't very often do it. But because Peter was coming and I wanted to see him, I thought this would be a nice day, which it was. And he presented, the arguments from his perspective and other, when we had a discussion with all the school kids. Now, he didn't tell of anything there which was of the sort of stunning kind of evidence that would change anything for me. It was very interesting, but it wasn't that kind of thing. Like, wow, maybe I should get back into this. Really, something has changed dramatically.
Okay. I don't think we can really push that too far because we just kind of set the parameters that I don't think it's really an area.
Well, if you could now, tell me of some amazing piece of evidence that, that would make me change my mind, then that would be interesting. But in the absence of that, I think we have to accept that there are lots and lots of possible ways of interpreting NDEs, and people differ, and the evidence is not conclusive on most of these issues. I mean, some things we know very well, don't we? We know roughly the proportions of people who have them. We know that that people are positively changed afterwards. We know something about those kinds of changes. We know that the various drugs, in particular painkillers and those kinds of things, weaken the near-death experiences or blur them rather than enhancing them. We know that levels of carbon dioxide are positively correlated with near-death experiences.
No, we don't. And I don't think we should get into it because you just said that you haven't followed it for 15 years. If you want to get into it, then I would put you opposite a researcher, Pin Van Lommel, or like I said, Dr. Jeff Long, Dr. Bruce Grayson, people who are really up to date on the research, who've published, who've collected data for 20 or 30 years, rather than you're doing this thing again where you say, I'm completely removed from the field. I don't have anything to say. I haven't researched. I haven't read any of the literature. I have a stack of books I haven't read, and none of them are even the NDE books. They're not even on my table. And then you're going to spout off all these things that you believe or that you assume to be true without looking at the research. I appreciate just having an opinion, but I got to ask, how well informed is it?
I'm really trying here to be as truthful as I can and correct about, to be honest about what I know and don't know. I know bits of it, but I certainly know those things that I have just said are things that over the years I have learned about. Now, it won't surprise me at all if you come up with something else that contradicts one of these or something, but those are things which I do know that has been researched. I mean, you jumped in on the carbon dioxide. Well, there's a Slovenian paper, I think, quite a lot of near-death experiences, 50-something of them were studied, and correlations found
11.
Between levels
they
of carbon dioxide.
They actually studied 11. The carbon dioxide levels really weren't elevated. They were statistically elevated slightly by one statistical measure between the two groups that they studied, but the levels aren't even higher than someone has when they're scuba diving. So it's really not strong evidence. We've dissected
right.
it quite
okay.
a bit on this show with several experts. So, yeah, that's not a strong
good.
Study.
Well, I will defer to those experts because they know more about it than me.
Okay, let's talk about something else that came up actually in our last interview and then in a subsequent interview after that. And it's something you've written more about and talked about, and that's Buddhism. And this is a little bit of a hot topic here because when I had you on, you're a Zen practitioner. And in your book on consciousness, you talk somewhat about the Buddhist tradition and how it fits in. So if I could, I want to play you this clip from Dr. Alan Wallace. He's a Buddhist scholar, and he had this to say about your work. Can I play this for you?
Okay.
What I found here in Susan Blackmore's writings, because I have read her primary book, her big book on consciousness, is when she surveys Western studies of consciousness and so forth, I think it's really quite a laudable effort. When she comes to her presentation of Buddhism, I have to say, rather sadly, it was the worst presentation of Buddhism I've seen in the English language. And I've been studying Buddhism for 37 years now. I'm fluent in Tibetan. I've studied Sanskrit, Buddhist monk for 14 years, and I don't know how many books I've published on the topic. But it was simply uninformed, and it was not only uninformed, which is nice, good straightforward ignorance, but this radical misconstrual and misinterpretation that I think no reputable Buddhist scholar could possibly accept. And so this was really quite discouraging that, and I find this not infrequent among people who are working in this field. They'll be very professional on one side and completely amateurish on the other.
Okay, and I realize that's a pretty harsh statement, but I wanted to get your response.
Oh, it certainly is harsh, and I wish he had come to me. I would love to have had the chance to talk to him about that. Well, yes, I don't claim to be a Buddhist scholar. I was giving an overview. What I was trying to do, this is a big textbook on consciousness, which is intended for undergraduate and probably master's level students in Britain and the United States primarily, studying consciousness. And they will mostly be studying physiology, neurophysiology, neuropsychology, all the different aspects of consciousness, and some more subjective stuff as well. And I was trying to put meditation and mindfulness and a little bit of basic Buddhist ideas into that book, because I think we shouldn't. The science of consciousness is rapidly expanding now and really going somewhere. And I think it was very sad if it concentrates entirely on the neuroscience and leaves out the personal practice. So that was the aim of putting that in there. Now, he says I'm uninformed. Well, I'm not. I'm not a Buddhist scholar. I don't read Sanskrit or the original languages. I'm not a scholar of Buddhism in that sense. But I have been training in Zen for 30 years now. I've also trained to some extent, much less in Tibetan practices. Most of what I wrote there is based on that long practice. Now, of course, Buddhists disagree. Like, Christians disagree and Muslims disagree, and there are all kinds of... I don't know why he was so scathing about it. It may be because I take a pretty radical interpretation of many of the Buddha's teachings, but that's kind of in the Zen tradition. Zen is kind of one end of the Buddhist traditions in the sense of sweeping away doctrine, sweeping away all sorts of stuff. And the basic practice of Zen is you sit down, look at a white wall, and shut up and see what's there. And it has very much less in the way of doctrine. Without knowing what it is he's objecting to, I'm not sure I can say much more. I would welcome taking it up with him.
Sure. Well, we can arrange that if you think that'd be useful. I tell you what I think.
Yeah, that would be very interesting.
Okay. I think a couple of things that he objects to is what you just alluded to. And one is that from a scholarship standpoint, I think we can say certain things about certain religious texts in the same way that, a practicing Roman Catholic for 30 years wouldn't be qualified to really speak on historical interpretations of these texts as much as a scholar would. And, to that...
That's true. But the Buddhist scholar I know best and admire greatly is Stephen Batchelor, who has written many books on Buddhism, and he does read Sanskrit and Pali and other early languages. He's translated books from those original languages. He's written critical books of various kinds, and he's written wonderful books, such as my favorite is his Buddhism Without Beliefs. And he's a lifelong practitioner and was a monk in the Far East for many, many years before he came back to Britain and started writing. And he's a great Buddhist teacher. And quite a lot of my knowledge, when I need to check something, I will check it with him. And I certainly checked all the content of that book with him and with other Buddhists I know. Because I'm really not a Buddhist. I've been practicing Zen. I will not claim to be a Buddhist. I haven't signed up to all these things. I've not taken any vows. I practice meditation and mindfulness, and Zen is a big part of my life, but not as a Buddhist. But I did ask some Buddhist friends to check the book, and I made some, changes in line with discussions that we had. And obviously, they thought it was at least, not making terrible mistakes. They were happy with it, let us say.
Okay, fair enough. Because what I was alluding to before is I think sometimes the details matter. I mean, sometimes don't. They don't. It's purely an interpretation, personal experience thing, and that's okay. But sometimes
Well, if there had been some little details in there that were wrong, I'm sure the people that John Crook, my Zen teacher, who has also written lots of books about Buddhism, I mean, he saw it as well and checked it. If there had been some details that were positively wrong, they would have been thrown out, I can assure you. So there must be the disagreement that Alan has with me must not be just some little erroneous details. There must be some more, I guess, fundamental difference of interpretation there.
There is, and I can send you the complete interview. I will do that after the show. I'll send you a link to it so you can listen to it. But here's what I was referring to when I was talking about the details. In your book, Dying to Live, you say this: the difference between these, that is Tibetan Buddhism teachings, and the folk tales we've encountered, i.e., you're talking about the near-death experience folktales, and it's a very big difference, you state, is that in Buddhism, these experiences are not meant to be taken literally. Now, there you're stating something quite matter-of-factly that I think is just, as far as I can tell from talking to researchers, Buddhist scholars, that's just flat-out incorrect.
What exact things are we talking about that are not to be taken literally? I'm sorry, I've not understood this. What exactly are these experiences that are not, or claims that are not to be taken literally?
Okay, so this is from your book, Dying to Live.
Yeah.
And you're talking about what's described in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, right? And you say that these Tibetan Buddhism teachings, leaving your body and going to another place, you're saying these are not to be taken literally. And yet, and you say the folk tales of NDE, which is, I think, a very derogatory term, but given that millions of people have had these experiences and consider them very much real and very significant, but to you, they're folk tales. And you say that in Buddhism, these experiences, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, are not to be taken literally. And I just don't see any support for that. I just don't think that's correct.
Well, I suppose I was probably speaking from my Zen background, where these things are not taken as literal, you know, adventures in literal other worlds, but ways.
But hold on. That's the point I'm making. Now we're talking about the Tibetan Book of the Dead, a writing from, I think it's like from 800 A.D., but it's part of the works of the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and it's either, you know, that part isn't open to interpretation from a Zen perspective, from someone who's a Zen practitioner. I wouldn't think. I think you've got to be right on that.
It's open to interpretation in all sorts of ways. I mean, if you think of the other religions in the world at that time, there are plenty of scholars and historians who would argue that we've got completely the wrong end of the stick in modern times. I'm reading at the moment The Case for God, and where she is a historian taking lots of historical details, argues that the Bible is like that. It wasn't read literally. That the whole idea of taking the Bible literally is actually a modern invention of the last 100 years or so, and that people they used it as guidance for their own life, for their own practice, to understand their own minds, but not in any sense literal. Now, I don't know. Perhaps I shouldn't have written that in 1993. I don't know. I don't remember the context. I'd have to go and look at it again. But there must be lots and lots of ways of understanding the Tibetan book and of using the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And I don't know, in the time that it was written, centuries and centuries ago, in what way it was intended. Nor do I know through how many translations it's gone to be in the form that we know it now, and how that has affected the way it's to be taken. I do know something from long, long Zen practice about the power of some of these ways of thinking about the mind to affect one's meditation, to affect one's state of mind, not by taking them literally, but by taking them as a kind of guidance to mental space or something like that. And that interests me far more deeply. And I've certainly met many, many very, very impressive practitioners of meditation and mindfulness who don't take these things literally, but to use them in their practice for all sorts of purposes to do with encouraging compassion, understanding emptiness, falling into oneness or no mind, and these kinds of things, rather than taking them literally. That's the sort of place that I would have been coming from in making that statement.
Okay, and I certainly appreciate that from both a spiritual perspective and just from the contemplative tradition that is Buddhism. I appreciate all the things that you're saying, but we are again dealing with this kind of interplay. And I realize, you know, you are a very entertaining both presenter and writer, and you're very obviously intelligent and well-informed. And at the same time, you know, I do think there's some fair criticism in the way sometimes you construct your arguments in a way that isn't really a fair fight. I mean, you said that these experiences from the Tibetan Book of the Dead are not to be taken literally. And now you're saying something that I can agree with, which is, hey, we're not sure whether those should really be taken literally in all cases. But that's not how you constructed the argument. And I think that one of the reasons, back to the original point of this interview, one of the reasons that skeptics latch on to your work is the style. They like someone to just say, these Tibetan experiences that are well documented, they're not to be taken literally. And what you're now fleshing out now is that that's not really a very scholarly or scientific way to approach things. And the same way, skeptics love when you say, I don't know if I could make it through Jeff Long's book, and I doubt that there's much there. They love that. But when you really dig into what you're saying is say, hey, you know, the guy did compile 2,000 cases. He's a medical doctor. He's published in many peer-reviewed journals, and I haven't read any of his work. I haven't read any of Pin Van Lommel's work, so I'm going to withdraw from making public scientific statements. Okay, I think we could all get on board with that. But you're kind of throwing meat to the crowd here, this other crowd, the skeptical crowd, that loves to hear you say these other things. I mean, do you understand where I'm coming from?
Well, yes, you said a lot of interesting things there. I mean, towards the beginning, I was thinking I wanted to say, well, yes, this is the point about how great the discussion is in science, is that I need the criticisms, because it's all too easy to, you know, spray out ideas, have lots of ideas, but I need the criticisms to then know which bits I have to work on or how to hone them up and so on. But I think you're kind of dragging me away from what's important to me and what I would like to talk about more, really, which is, what is all this telling us about the mind and about who we are and about what the potential of the human mind is?
It's telling us that the mind is not reducible to brain function. That is as clear as it could be. And once we cross that chasm, you and I could have a really interesting discussion. But if you want to stay on the other side of that cliff and hold on to something that's totally not true, and it's so proven to be not true,
I have never said that the mind is totally reducible to the brain. That's a completely, reducibility is a very, very strong demand. And I don't think I wouldn't say that. I would say that you don't have mind without a brain and a body and a world for it to emerge from, but that's different from it being reducible.
Well, we're not sure on, and I'd say we're not sure on that second point, but
of course,
I'd also say...
I would say, I'm on one side and you're on the other of that one.
Right, but then I'd also suggest that if you look at the trend line and you look at where you've moved, where science has moved in the last 20 years, last 50 years, is certainly the trajectory is to jump over the chasm, not to stay on the other side, and to say that that mind is not reducible. But we're going to hold on to this idea that it only works inside of this little box here that's on top of your head. I think that's harder and harder to hold on to.
Well, it's hard from lots of points. There's a huge change gone on in cognitive science in the last 10 years or so towards embodied theories of consciousness, embodied theories of perception, and so on, which make, and it's happening also in work in artificial intelligence and machine consciousness, realizing that you can't just talk about a brain on its own. I mean, it's just a bunch of neurons. And that's why a moment ago I said, when I was jumping on this irreducibility business, I mentioned a brain and a body and a world, because I think you have to have all of those three things interacting before there's mind or mental phenomena or experiences or subjectivity or illusions of self or whatever else it might be. It's not just a brain. A brain on its own is just can't do anything. I want to think about another chasm. You see, this is a vast chasm of dualism. This is at the heart of all these problems that we face in trying to understand the mind, in trying to understand death, and so on. The natural human way to think seems to be dualist, seems to be that mind and brain are somehow separate. and we struggle to try to make sense of them. Now, in the scientific realm, you have this awful dualism, which led to swinging backwards and forth, and particularly the relationship between psychology and what is now becoming neuroscience. And the whole sad history of behaviorism, which was a large part of the 20th century, was not being able to cope with dualism. We'll just make it all brain, and we'll ignore that there's any mind at all, and simply push it away and not do anything with it. And that's what behaviorism did, and was successful in keeping anyone from talking about mind for a very long time. Well, then along come it finally broke back again, and then we've struggled and struggled for the last part of the 20th century and the first part of this to try and make some kind of connection between the two. And I'm there with my textbook on consciousness, trying to keep both in there all the time interacting. But the way the science goes very often is it's too difficult to cope with experience and subjectivity. We'll try and understand it all in terms of just what the brain is doing. And then people fight back, and there's constant to-ing and fro-ing over the problem of dualism. And interestingly now, lots of research coming along from young children showing that that way of thinking is very natural to young children from 3 or 4, very early on when they learn language. They start thinking of mind and brain as separate. Now then we have the whole religious and spiritual traditions in which again and again, not just in Buddhism, in Christian mysticism, in naturally occurring spontaneous mystical experiences, again and again, people will describe the end of dualism. They will say they had this experience, I've had many of these experiences myself, where simply mind and brain are no longer separate. Self and other is no longer separate. There is complete harmony and oneness of self and other, and you kind of laugh at, you know, how could I have thought that I was ever separate from everybody else and everything else? And it seems then quite resolved. And you can say, turning to Buddhism in particular, it's sometimes said in Zen that the end is the realization of non-duality, realization in the sense of making real non-duality, and that all are illusions and hatred and delusion and greed, all of this stems from the false sense of being separate from the universe that we inhabit. Now, that gulf, that dualist breakdown, that's what I think is really at the heart of what I've been trying to do all my life, is struggling around that and trying to make sense of it, trying to find a way through that is not dualistic, separate, that does not encourage selfishness and greed and delusion.
That's an interesting path you just took us on. It really is. And especially it's the topic I'm very interested in, is kind of this looking at both our scientific empiricism and our spiritual traditions and trying to somehow sort out what is true, as much as, you know, true is really kind of a funny thing, the concept to latch onto. But having said that, I'd go back to the very first part that you talked about in terms of dualism. Where you come around full circle is kind of saying that this whole idea of dualism, this whole little jaunt we've taken in science, was a misstep. And I think that recasts the whole thing. I mean, if science has really been on this, in terms of consciousness, has really been on this sidetrack that really doesn't work, then don't we kind of make too much of it when we say, oh, and look at how interesting it was when we looked at behaviorism and we took out all these sidetracks, when it's like, yeah, but that was wrong. And first point I have to disagree with, and that's where you said you think that human beings naturally kind of gravitate towards, what did you say, towards a dualistic kind of...
That mind and brain are separate. They seem to be such different kind of things, and we talk about them differently and think about
right.
You know, think about myself, my experiences as not the world as being there as causing my experiences. You think about experiences as separate from the world, and mind and brain being different things.
Right, but there's also a long tradition of non-dualism, right? I mean,
yes, absolutely, and this is the tension between the people who have somehow seen through this dualism, but the normal way that's embedded in our language and much of our culture is dualist. It's why Descartes was so popular, you know, with Cartesian dualism and the, you know, the separate sort of realms of the mind and the world. that it doesn't work scientifically. And the scientists, yes, we keep saying that, well, we were wrong. The whole behaviorist tradition had some good things in it. But, you know, that attempt to kind of do away with mind or subjective experience was wrong. We must come back to it. And that, I'm happy to say, has happened in my lifetime, really beginning in the mid-1990s, when it began to be possible, scientifically acceptable, to talk about consciousness again. And this great sort of flowering of people being able to talk about it, and then the constant kind of dragging back to pinning it down to some little bit of the brain or something, and kind of finding it terribly, terribly hard to do justice to the nature of personal experience while studying the brain. It's a terribly hard challenge. It's called the hard problem of consciousness. The hard problem of consciousness is defined as trying to understand how subjective experience can arise from objective brain events. And that's a massive challenge.
Right. Well, I think, as you alluded to earlier in our discussion, and as you said in your book, Dying to Live, and that's that if it is proven that consciousness might exist without a functioning brain, then you really have to rethink all of your ideas.
Completely.
I think if we look at the research in the last 15 years that's been compiled by the best researchers in the field of near-death experience, I think we're there. I think people who hold off and saying that we're there are really kind of, you know, just trying to hold back the wall. But I think that's why this research is so important and so relevant and really needs to be studied so thoroughly.
But if we are there, then we should have some good theories that explain why near-death experiences are the way they are. I mean, for example, why...
We cannot say that one doesn't lead to the other. The fact that we've compiled some very impressive evidence, highly suggestive of the fact that consciousness survives bodily death, does not automatically lead to some time frame during which we should have developed well-formed theories about how it works. Those two don't necessarily follow.
You could say that, you know, it hasn't happened yet and it will. But people who think that near-death experiences are evidence for life after death expect those of us who think that they're not to come up with complete theories and complete predictions and all sorts of evidence. And I mean, and we've done fairly well, but certainly not provided them.
No, you haven't done so very well. The history really is that all the nice ideas that have been put forth have been really handled pretty well from, you know, and we've had those folks on the show. I mean, so you got Kevin Nelson in the last few years comes along with REM intrusion, you know. Well, that's handled pretty well. You have the Slovenian doctors, as we mentioned, with the carbon elevated levels of CO2 in the blood. That's addressed pretty well in the evidence that we have. There really isn't a lot of stuff hanging out there yet to be addressed. The point that you're making is that, yeah, we have the evidence that suggests it's not these other things, but we don't have a complete theory about how it works. If you want to make that criticism, fine. Yeah, that's true.
But you don't really have anything. All you have is a statement that there's a mystery here, and you're proposing a complete non-explanation. In other words, there's something like a spirit or a soul or something of that kind that survives death.
But Sue, hold on. That doesn't say anything. But when the mystery is that we're observing a highly advanced cognitive process of consciousness, when there is no brain activity, well, that's more than just a little mystery. It is the central issue. So just to jump over that.
Okay, and I have yet to be persuaded that the evidence really suggests that.
But you haven't read anything in the last 15 years.
Well, I think we've been over that discussion enough.
All right.
Let me say something else. I mean, you concentrate on some aspects, understandably, certain aspects of the work I did all that long time ago on near-death experiences, but you don't mention what the book was really about, what my conclusions at the end of it, and why, what drove me to this to the work in the first place, which is this. My alternative theory is not some sort of theory. Well, let's say what it is, not what it's not. My alternative theory is something like this. Most of us, most of our lives, live in illusion. We think that we are somehow a separate mind inhabiting our body, that we are in charge of our body, that we are a persisting entity that lives our life and that is in some ways separable from our body, and therefore that it makes sense for it to leave our body. This radical kind of ordinary human dualism is the kind of ordinary state most of us live in. It's not actually a very happy state to be in. It's not a very compassionate or loving state to be in, but it's kind of the basic human way to live. Now, some people have the luck to have spontaneous mystical experiences in which they blast out of that and realize that it's possible to be outside of that cage, if you like, to see the world differently, to understand immediately the interrelatedness of the universe, the oneness of everything, and the fact that these little selves are actually not important or persisting or the way we felt they were before. Other people learn through prayer and contemplation within mystical traditions in any of the great religions or in some alternative religions as well. They will find by long practice or through fasting and other techniques, they will also find the same thing. Or you have in some aspects of Hinduism and within Buddhism, practices actually directed at seeing through duality and understanding oneness and emptiness. All over the world, these great traditions. Now, it seems to me, from both having had these experiences and having practiced meditation for 30 years, having taken a lot of very interesting drugs, done a lot of strange techniques for mind altering, from all of this experience, it seems to me that the near-death experience is another one of these types of things that can happen. The reason it happens is because of the breakdown of the normal capacity of the brain, which is where all the, you know, the carbon dioxide and the excessive firing in the visual system and so on come from. But the important thing about all this to me is that it's a way in which the illusion of separate self can be broken through. And then that's what I'm saying at the end of the book. I say this is why people are changed for the better after near-death experiences, because they have glimpsed, perhaps for the only time in their life, the possibility of knowing that they are not separate from everybody and everything else. In fact, it is all one, and that separate self that they thought was so important is actually just a passing story and not so important. And that's why they become more compassionate, more caring, less interested in fame and glory and money and so on. That's what I want. That was what my book was about. That's the context of me trying to understand what's happening in the brain when people come close to death and survive.
You know, philosophically, we could sit down and have a really nice chat, and I'm much closer to you philosophically than further apart. I mean, this is my spiritual practice, my yoga tradition, my Hindu and Buddhist leanings are all in line with that. But I really draw a distinction. I love science, and I know you love science too. I love the scientific method, the means of understanding. And where I pull back from a lot of what you're saying is that I think people should be very skeptical of a lot of the things that you're saying, because they're opinions. They're interesting opinions, but they step way outside of the realm of what we know, what we can prove by scientific methods. And that's what I guess I react to, and I think I was really trying to tease out, and I appreciate your openness in having this dialogue that's, you know, critical and really pulling at each other and stuff like that. But it's like, you know what? When it comes to the ideas in your book and the thoughts, philosophies, musings of your book, awesome, great. But what we really have to do, what I really want to do, is try and tease out the science. What do we know by the best means we have? Knowing full well when we walk into that we're never really going to know anything, that there isn't any truth. It's all relative to some extent. But we do have this common shared experience that we can get to, and we're going to call that, for sake of argument, truth. And that's where we have to try and get.
Yep, oh, I agree with you. And I enjoy it. I mean, it's painful in a way. This, you know, this discussion. You've pushed very hard, and it's quite painful and tough. But it's what it's about. I mean, if you throw yourself into things like I do and put out opinions, and people be working for them, you know, it's part of what you're doing is to hear these different points of view and try to deal with them as best I can, and try to think and try to always develop my ideas and my opinions in light of what I know. And, you know, I learn a lot from discussions like this.
Right.
So, fine.
So where is all this thinking and all these interesting exchanges. Where is that taking you right now? What are you working on now? Where will people find you in the next year or two? Books, lectures, those kinds of things.
In my garden by a little river just south of Dartmoor in South Devon, I am trying to do less work, less writing. I'm not writing any book at the moment. It's very, very hard. The modern world, you know, people can very easily get to you, and it's very hard to extricate yourself. But I do realize that I have burdened myself very much with the enjoyment, really, of, you know, fairly successful books and lots of lectures and all of this stuff. And I am now doing more Zen practice and meditation. I've taken up painting again, and above all, I'm doing a lot of gardening and so on. We have 7 acres on the edge of this little river in Devon. I grow a lot of vegetables. We have chickens. We are trying to get our carbon footprint as low as possible. We heat the house mostly, not entirely, but mostly with our own wood, so it's carbon neutral, which was an awful lot of time spent splitting and chopping wood to prepare it for this winter, which we're doing at the moment. We've, you know, installed solar panels of both kinds, and we're working on these kinds of things and trying to find ways to grow more food and so on. I've realized I've spent quite a lot of time with my Zen teacher because he's not been well, and along with other people I've been helping to look after him for a bit, and that's been a wonderful opportunity for practice. And he's got at me and said his latest instruction is enjoy slowly. You laugh. You can see where that's coming from, can't you? Which is, I'm pathologically unable either to just enjoy things for their own sake or to do things slowly. So that may not have been the answer you were expecting, but that's kind of what I'm up to at the moment.
Well, I think that's wonderful, and I think it is very, very much a part of this discussion, because it's this balancing act, and we are living a life. We're not just, so you're talking about the balance you have between being a public figure and standing behind a lot of works that people identify with you and carrying on with a life that, you know, may take you in slightly different directions that people don't know about. So yeah. I certainly appreciate the fact that you've been so open in this dialogue and you've taken the time to join us. And I thank you very much for that.
Pleasure. I have enjoyed it, despite the tough grilling you've given me. I enjoyed it. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks again to Dr. Susan Blackmore for joining me today on Skeptico. It was a tough interview. I really commend her for hanging in there and answering tough questions and being willing to engage. You know, it's one of my great frustrations when people who espouse critical thinking are unwilling to critically look at their own ideas. And as you can tell, Dr. Blackmore doesn't fall into that category. She's not only willing to dialogue about these tough issues, but she's willing to take a hard look at her own views and how those stack up. And you just can't ask for anything more than that. So I provided a couple links in the show notes to this show. If you'd like to check those out, please visit the Skeptico website. It's at skeptiko.com. You'll also find links to all our previous shows, an email link to me. Have a couple of interesting interviews coming up. I'm especially excited about the next interview coming up with Dr. Jeff Kripal on his book, Authors of the Impossible. I think you'll find that real interesting as well. Well, that's going to do it for today. Until next time, bye for now.